This lesson was taught on September 26, 1999, at the Reformed Baptist Church of Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Let me encourage those of you who are sitting over there. You're not going to be able to see the projector or anything, so if you could very kindly move into the second or third sections, you'll be able to profit better than if you're sitting in that section over there. All right, I've got a couple of announcements here. First of all, Joel Merrick, you received honors in the class last 2 years, and you need to come and pick up your gift certificate. If you're in here this morning, I have it. And then some of you have asked about notes for the class, and the notes for this class are available, at least substantially, in a manuscript that we do have in connection with the School of Theology in the church office. However, because it does cost us a good little money to make those manuscripts, I don't think that it's necessarily going to be profitable to try to provide everyone in the class with one of those manuscripts of the notes. But if you're interested in having one, I will be following it rather closely in the class, although not perfectly, and it would give you the substance of all the lectures. So if you would be pleased to... If you want that manuscript, you can purchase it at the church office. All right. Now, this morning we return to listening in on a great conversation, as we have called it. The great conversation that's been taking place in the church with regard to the subject of last things. And I want to review this morning what we have been talking about in our consideration, our listening in on that great conversation, and then proceed to listen to a little more of it this morning. Remember that we divided this great conversation that we've been listening to into two parts: the great conversation about eschatology, or the doctrine of last things in the early and medieval church until around the year 1500, and then the conversation in the Reformation and modern church, which takes us to the present. I'm doing this because I think if you listen in on this conversation for a while before you join it in this class, you'll be able to understand the terminology and maybe begin to understand the right questions to ask of the Bible when we come to ask the Bible itself what it teaches with regard to this matter. We began by looking at the Apostolic Fathers and considering what they had to say with regard to this matter. We saw that they all were in agreement with regard to the core issues that all Christians agree about with regard to the doctrine of last things. Things like eternal punishment and the bodily resurrection were things they all agreed about. But there was this dispute, even in the early church, about premillennialism, which was debated. And we saw the nature of the question. The question is not the imminent return of Christ or the doctrine of the personal Antichrist. Those things are sometimes associated with premillennialism, but other people believe them, so the fact that someone believes those things does not make them a premillennialist. And then we examined the evidence. We saw Papias. Papias was probably a premillennialist, but side by side with his premillennialism, which he supposedly got from the disciples of John the Apostle, he taught other things that he supposedly got from the disciples of John that are clearly fanciful and not to be equated with Scripture or thought to be true. We looked at the Epistle of Barnabas, the other place in the Apostolic Fathers where there's a thought to be evidence for the whole matter of premillennialism. Here we saw that there were many problems with the supposed evidence. First, the language of the chapter is terribly opaque and confusing. Second, the idea of the history of the world corresponding to the 6 days of creation is without basis in the Bible. Third, this chapter is more consistent in several respects with amillennialism than premillennialism. And I'm not taking the time right now to define those big terms because I'm going to do so very shortly. And so we saw that the idea that the Apostolic Fathers in the early church were premillennial almost to a man is really overstatement and wishful thinking. Now, We went on then to talk about, after the apostolic fathers, the growth of early premillennialism. And there was a growth. Premillennialism flourished from about the 2nd to the 4th century. Justin Martyr was a premillennialist, although we saw that he was the kind of premillennialist that today is called an historic premill, and there are also things that were inconsistent in what he said. Other early premillennialists were Irenaeus, the church father, Tertullian, and the Montanists, as they were called. The Montanists were the early charismatics in the early church, believing both in the continuation of prophecy and in the ministry of women. Other premillennialists were in the early church, and we brought all this to a conclusion and said, how do we explain in the early church the fact that there was all this premillennialism if we aren't satisfied just to say, well, it came right down from the apostles? Well, we saw that there was another explanation. The other explanation is that it's possible that premillennialism originated within ancient Judaism, because in ancient Jewish books before the time of Christ, they were not inspired during the intertestamental period, as it's called, the 400 silent years between the close of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. There were ancient Jewish books that taught that there would be a period of the Messiah's reign before the coming of the eternal state at the final judgment. And so it's possible that some early Christians, many of whom were Jews, didn't see anything inconsistent with that in their newfound Christianity and imported it into Christianity. We don't have to assume, just because many early Christians were premillennial, that they all were. And of course, we saw that just as there's evidence that there were many early premillennialists, there's also clear evidence from premillennialists themselves that there are many early Christians who were not premillennial and who were still genuine Christians. And Justin Martyr himself, Eusebius of Caesarea, and others fit into the category of bearing witness to that. And so we came to the withering of early premillennialism because it did not continue to flourish. And we asked, why did it wither? Well, for a couple of reasons. There were the excesses of Montanism. All those Montanistic prophecies that were predicting the end of the world and the coming of the millennium, the return of Christ to Papusa and Phrygia, didn't come true. In fact, there was an unusual time of peace for the next 30 years after those prophets died. And Montanism was condemned in the early church for its adding to the canon and saying that its prophecies were equivalent to the canon of the New Testament, and early synods condemned it. And along with the condemnation of Montanism, premillennialism fell into disrepute. And then there was also the verdict of Augustine, who in his City of God came out against premillennialism, said, I once believed it myself, but now I understand that it's a kind of carnal doctrine and that it's not necessary to understand Revelation chapter 20 in the way premillennialists do. And so he came out against it, and that was the verdict of Augustine. So we could chart. Someone said this should have been a bell curve. And that's kind of true. You could do this in a bell curve. You can chart the growth of early premillennialism and then its withering to about the time of Augustine in the year 400, and 4,000 years after that. The church was settled against premillennialism because primarily of the verdict of Augustine and the excesses of Montanism. All right? Now, we're going to come on this morning to deal with the doctrine of the medieval church about last things. Doctrine of last things. And here I'll stop moving at such a hasty pace because we were simply reviewing and try to slow down and make sure that we get this stuff in the right order and clearly. Now, this is our fourth and last head under section one of our studies. The pronouncements of Augustine against premillennialism were of high authority throughout the period of the medieval church and even into the Reformation. Calvin himself probably held the same approximate view as Augustine held about 1,100 years later. Yet the seemingly straightforward amillennialism of the city of God, which the 1,000 years of Revelation 20 is identified with the gospel age before, between the first advent of Christ and the second advent of Christ, that seemingly straightforward amillennialism of the city of God is not the whole story about Augustine's eschatology. Now, before we go any further, I'm going to take the opportunity now to remind you of the three major millennial views that by the time of the Reformation were beginning to develop. Here they are. And this nice, nifty overhead, I have to give credit to Steve Harwood for that. Thank you. All right. Now, let's remind ourselves of the three major views of the millennium that Christians have held. We looked at premillennialism already. I've been referring to it, which says that history is basically like this. You have the Old Covenant, a period of the law. You have the cross and resurrection of Christ. Then you have the Gospel Age. And then, according to premillennialism, Christ comes before the millennium. He reigns on earth. After the millennium, there's the final judgment. And then you have the eternal state. Right? Clear? Now, the view of amillennialism is this. And this we said, was Augustine's view. And the view that dominated the medieval church. You have the Old Covenant, the cross and resurrection of Christ, the gospel age, which is equated with the millennium of Revelation 20. Christ is reigning in heaven, although his reign is not perfected on earth. There's the second coming of Christ and the eternal state. Right? That's amillennialism. Now, the view I want to say that Augustine, in a sense, anticipated is the third major millennial view. It's postmillennialism. Right? Postmillennialism says, of course, you have the Old Covenant, period of the law, then there's the cross and resurrection of Christ. And then the period between the cross and resurrection of Christ and his second advent, between his first and second advent, is subdivided into two periods. We'll call them the period of the humiliation of the church, and then the period of the exaltation of the church. Postmillennialism basically teaches that before Christ returns, there's going to be this long golden age of righteousness and peace and prosperity in the world in which the church will triumph over evil, and the gospel will triumph over evil. Not perfectly, but substantially. And then Christ will come, and then you have the eternal state. And that's postmillennialism. All right? Now, let me show you them again. Premillennialism. 1,000 years is Christ comes before the 1,000 years, hence premillennial. Amillennialism. There is no 1,000 years in the future apart from the gospel age, so there's no millennialism. Amillennialism. And then there's post-millennialism. And this is the idea that Christ comes post the millennium or after the millennium. All right? Now, what I'm trying to say here is that Augustine, though in some places clearly he writes as an amillennialist, also anticipates in seed form a kind of postmillennialism. All right? You're going to understand some of the things we're going to say this morning. You've got to understand that. Now, why do I say that? Well, Augustine, like every Christian, had his inconsistencies. And one of the things that happened to Augustine in North Africa, where he labored, and where he was bishop in Hippo, a town called Hippo, was that he got into this controversy with the people called the Donatists. The Donatists. The Donatists were the kind of separatist church in North Africa. 100 years previously, there had been this cleavage, this division in the church in North Africa. It had to do with things that ultimately were pretty dumb, I have to tell you. But there was this cleavage, all right? And now you had two churches. And Augustine was leading in his ministry the resurgence of what we might call the, not the Roman Catholic Church, but the old Catholic Church in North Africa. And he was engaged in a fight against the Donatists, the separatist church. Now, ultimately, Augustine decided that it would be a good idea if those dirty, rotten Donatists were suppressed by the government. And that was a possibility, of course, because the government was now the Roman Empire that had turned Catholic Christian in about the year 325 or about 75 years previously. And so it was a real possibility to appeal to the government to suppress the Donatists and to support the Catholic Church in North Africa. Now, Augustine, sadly enough, with all the good things about him, presented a theological justification for using the state to physically coerce the heretical or unconverted into the right religion. All right? So substantially, he provided a theological justification for the state, the Christian state, suppressing non-Catholic churches. Now, this is called, this view is called Christian sacralism. A sacral society is a society in which you can only have one religion. Or you can sum up sacralism this way. One religion, one state. One state, one religion. You couldn't possibly. And in fact, all societies previous to the coming of Christ were all sacral in character. So theoretically, every society was sacral. You couldn't have more than one religion in one society. If you had more than one religion, it would split society up and would destroy the state, they thought. So you had to have one religion in one state in one religion. That's sacralism. Well, basically, Augustine bought into that view, sadly enough, and he presented a theological justification that there could only be one church in North Africa, the Catholic Church. Now, to do this, to justify all this, Augustine had to begin to tinker around with his theological views that he'd always held. Here's what somebody says. He had changed his mind on one point only. 10 years previously, he had thought that the ages before the coming of Christianity belonged to a more primitive stage of moral evolution. And that in his own days, Christianity was purely spiritual religion. It had risen entirely above the physical sanctions and the enforced observances of that shadowy past. Now Augustine was no longer so sure. Augustine now began to appeal to the Old Testament to justify physical sanctions against unbelievers. In other words, to justify coercing them by judicial penalties into becoming religious in the right sense of the word, in his own sense of the word. Verdun, another writer, says, it was easy for Augustine to slide back from Constantine, the Roman emperor who had first become Christian, to David, from the church state now known as Christendom, to the church state that was Israel. That backward slide is easy in the context of a flat theology. Catch what he said? I'll read it again. It was easy for Augustine to slide back from Constantine to David and from the church state now known as Christendom to the church state that was Israel. That backward slide is easy in the context of a flat theology. Here's what he's saying. What Augustine finally ended up doing, because he wanted to justify the Roman Empire suppressing the Donatist churches, was they ended up equating the Christianized Roman Empire that had come into being under Constantine with the Old Testament theocracy under David. And so what David could do in Old Testament Israel, now Constantine could do in the modern times of the year 400 in order to suppress the wrong religion. David had a responsibility in Israel to suppress the wrong religion. And so now Constantine and his successors also have a responsibility there in the year 400 to suppress the wrong religion. Simple, right? But there's only one problem. In order to get from here to here, you have to have a flat theology. In other words, you have to see the Old Testament situation as on the same level with the New Testament situation. Now, before, Augustine had thought that the New Testament situation was not on the same level. It was higher because of what had happened when Christ came. But now, he begins to flatten out his theology, and he can go back along a smooth road and equate the Roman Empire now with the Old Testament theocracy because it's Christianized. Boy, is that making any sense to you? You understand that? Now, when he did that, he had to do away with the true early and late in the Bible. In the Bible, there's an early and a late. The early is the Old Testament situation with its types and shadows. The late in the Bible is the New Testament situation with its fulfillment and reality. Well, now, Constantine had to forget about that early and late, and he had to come up with another early and late. Why? Well, because some people said, just a second, Augustine. Okay, yeah, you've got the Old Testament, but that was different. Where do you find any place in the New Testament Christians appealing to the state to suppress and to persecute their enemies? Where do you find that in the New Testament, Augustine? And Augustine answered this way. A complaint was raised by some who were having difficulty accepting the idea of compulsion in the things of the faith. And this difficulty was that there was no example found in the writing of the evangelists and the apostles, the New Testament, of any petition presented in behalf of the church to the kings of the earth against her enemies. Precisely what Augustine and his large following were now doing. In his letter to Vincentius, Augustine replied. Now, what did Augustine say? These people are saying, where do you find anything like this in the New Testament, Augustine? How do you justify this in the writings of the Gospels or the apostles? And Augustine said, wait. Here's my answer. What's his answer? It's this. Who denies this? Augustine says, of course, no place in the New Testament. I acknowledge that. Who denies this? None such is to be found. But at that time the prophecy, be wise now therefore, O ye kings, be instructed, ye judges of the earth, serve the Lord with fear, was not yet fulfilled. Augustine's answer about when people said, you can't find this in the New Testament, Augustine, was that, well, this is a different situation now. The New Testament was different. Then, the prophecy wasn't fulfilled. Now it is. Now we've come into the period of the exaltation of the church. You see it? Now the church is no longer humiliated under the thumb of opposing rulers. So, of course, there's no instance of anybody in the New Testament appealing to the rulers to help them because the rulers wouldn't help them. It would be ridiculous. But now the church has been exalted. Now the Roman Empire has become Christian. Now we can appeal to the rulers to support the right religion and to put down the wrong religion. You see what he's done? He said there is this qualitative, significant, important difference between the situation in the New Testament times and the situation which we're in now. You follow that? Now, Augustine thought he was already in that new situation. But many have been Christians who have thought, well, that while they're not in that situation yet, that a period of time is coming that will be like that. And before the second coming of Christ. And so you couldn't really call Augustine, in a strict sense, perhaps a postmillennialist. But in his idea, that we now have a completely different situation from the New Testament times into the time that the church now lives, which is exalted in triumph over the kings of the earth. In that, you have this basic idea that there can be this new period of time into which the church enters before the second coming of Christ, which is significantly, qualitatively, wonderfully different than the period of time in which the church was persecuted in the New Testament. Now, I'll give you time to ask questions about that, so just hold your questions here for a few minutes. But that's basically where Augustine was and why I say that he kind of anticipated postmillennialism in what he was saying about the persecution of the Donatists. Now, here, and my outline doesn't work out very well because right in the middle of this Sunday school lesson we have to go to section 2, the conversation, the great conversation in the Reformation and modern church. So now we're going to go to the time of the Reformation. So we're skipping over 1,100 years. You got Augustine, and time warp, now we're in the year 1500, okay? But now, actually that time warp doesn't accomplish much because nothing much has changed with regard to eschatology in that 1,100 years. All right? Now, I want to say some things by way of introduction about the eschatology, the doctrine of last things, and the Reformation. I want to say some things about that, and then we'll go on from there. Eschatology and the Reformation. First of all, I want to say something about the heritage of the Reformation. The Reformation took place in the context of Augustinianism. And that was true in a number of different respects. It was true in terms of the doctrine of salvation, their doctrine of irresistible grace, their doctrine of election, their doctrine of salvation by grace alone. But it was also true of their eschatology. Both Calvin and Luther were convinced Augustinians. Calvin quotes Augustine more than he quotes every other writer of the Christian church put together in his institute. And Luther, before he came out of the Roman Catholic Church, was an Augustinian monk. All right? Now, the Reformation then really inherited and for the most part adopted without modification the old amillennialism of Augustine as laid out in the City of God. The early reformers, such as Calvin and Luther and many of their other lesser lights, were thoroughgoing Augustinians. And thus, it's not surprising that the Reformation was, in terms of its eschatology, basically characterized by this old amillennialism of Augustine. All right? Now, but there was one innovation that took place at the time of the Reformation. At only one place can the Reformation be identified with the innovation or a contribution or some distinction with regard to eschatological teaching. And this has to do with the forthright identification of the papacy as the Antichrist. And here, the reformers agreed. This was something that had never been taught before, at least not so clearly. There might have been some reformers during the medieval times that had kind of anticipated this. But both Calvin and Luther agreed that the Pope and the papacy, the line of popes, was the Antichrist. This was the view of the eschatologically bold Luther. This was the view of the more reserved Calvin. It was the view of Protestants in general that the papacy was the Antichrist. Now, the confident identification of the papacy with the Antichrist was pregnant with all sorts of eschatological implications which for the next two or three centuries are going to come up in the history of the church. This identification had lots of consequences. When this rock was tossed into the pond, ripples went out everywhere. Now, in Luther, although not apparently in Calvin, this identification of the papacy as the Antichrist led to the view called historicism. Now, here. We're going to have to look at this in just a second. Let's see where I put that. Here we go. I have another one of Mr. Harwood's nifty overheads, so I'm going to use it here. Luther, as a result of his identifying the Pope as the Antichrist, or the line of popes as the Antichrist, taught the view known as historicism. And this is the view that the book of Revelation provides a consecutive, symbolic account of history from the resurrection of Christ to the eternal state. In other words, what you have in the book of Revelation is our symbols that have certain meanings, and what they do is step by step, in a chronological way, give you the history of the world from the first advent of Christ to the end of the world. And so if you knew enough about prophecy, and if you could interpret those symbols right, you could put yourself right at Revelation 15:3. This is where we're at. Everything after Revelation 15:3 is coming. Everything before Revelation 15:3 has already taken place. All you have to do is have the right key to interpret those symbols, and you could do that. This was historicism. Okay? Historicism. Now, as I said, you need, if you're going to do that wonderful trick of biblical interpretation, you need to discern the true teaching of these books. You need a symbolic and figurative system of interpretation. And often associated with this historicist method of interpretation was the theory that the days of prophecy stand for years. There was the day-year theory. The day-year theory. And this led to the idea that the 1260 days, Revelation 11:3 and Revelation 12:6 mentions the 1260 days, these 1260 days stood for an important prophetic period of 1260 years during the present age. Somehow or other, some place in the present age, connected with the papacy being the Antichrist, was this period of 1260 days, which were thought to be years, that if you could just identify what was the end and what was the beginning, you could know exactly where you're at in prophecy. Okay. Now, what's interesting is that the Roman Catholics began to feel the heat of this. And so, their theologians went to work and invented not one, but two alternative theories of how to interpret the book of Revelation. Now, these two other theories completely contradicted each other, but the thing that they had in common was that both were intended to blunt the edge of this historicist sword that the Protestants were using against the Catholics. One of them went to work, one of their theologians went to work, and invented the system called preterism. Preterism. And the another went to work and invented the system called futurism. Alright? Let me quote from one church historian. Rome's answer to the Protestant Reformation was twofold, though actually conflicting and contradictory. Through the Jesuits, that's a Roman Catholic order, the Jesuits, Ribera was his name, R-I-B-E-R-A, Ribera of Salamanca, Spain, and Bellarmine of Rome, the papacy put forth her futurist interpretation. And through Alcazar, Spanish Jesuit of Seville, she advanced almost simultaneously the conflicting preterist interpretation. These were designed to meet and overwhelm the historical, or historicist, interpretation of the Protestants. Though mutually exclusive, either Jesuit alternative suited the great objective equally well, as both thrust aside the application of the prophecies from the existing Church of Rome. The one accomplished it by making prophecy stop altogether short of papal Rome's career. The other achieved it by making it overleap the immense era of papal dominance, crowding Antichrist into a small fragment of time in the still distant future just before the great consummation. Now, let me explain what he just said. The historicist method basically was able to identify the papacy as the Antichrist because it saw the book of Revelation as giving a symbolic account of the whole of present human history in consecutive order. All right? Now, the Roman Catholics, in order to beat that, had to somehow debunk that historicist method. Here's what they did. Some of them took up the preterist method. The preterist method basically says all of the book of Revelation was basically fulfilled, with a few exceptions, before and at the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Now, you can see how neat that was. If the whole book of Revelation was fulfilled, or at least most of it, before 70 AD, then obviously it can't be talking about the Roman Catholic popes. Right? The other way of beating the historicist method was go to the other end and say, oh, no. The book of Revelation, beginning at least at chapter 4, and going all the way to the end, doesn't have to do with anything present at all. It has to do with the future. It has to do with the future seven-year period of tribulation after this present age is over, and with the an Antichrist that's going to come in that future period of time just before the second coming of Christ. Actually, the book of Revelation has only to do with that future period of time just before the second coming of Christ and after that. And so again, that beat the historicist method by saying, well, the book of Revelation doesn't have anything to do about the present. It's all about the future, which hasn't arrived yet. Period of time just before the second coming of Christ. And so you see the three methods? Historicism says the book of Revelation provides a consecutive symbolic account of history from the resurrection of Christ to the eternal state. Preterism says the book of Revelation deals mainly with events that took place leading up to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Futurism says the book of Revelation deals mainly with events beginning with the Great Tribulation just before the return of Christ. Historicism was the invention of Protestants, and preterism and futurism were both the inventions of Jesuit Roman Catholic theologians. All right, now, I have just one more little thing that we're going to get into now. Before I open it up for questions. And that's this. We're going to come now and consider this great conversation in the modern era by talking about the three millennial views that we've been laying out. We're going to talk about the rise of postmillennialism after the Reformation, the reaction of premillennialism, and the return of amillennialism. I'm saying, this is kind of, some of you have philosophy in college will appreciate this, no one else will, but there's a kind of thesis, and then there's the antithesis, and then there's the synthesis. There's the rise of postmillennialism, there's the reaction of premillennialism, there's the return of amillennialism. All right? Now we're just going to get to the first Roman numeral this morning. The rise of postmillennialism. Now, what Augustine had kind of just in seed form anticipated began to grow after the Reformation, but it didn't happen all at once. Here's how it happened. Millennial expectations of both the premillennial and postmillennial varieties gradually grew up in the context of the Puritan movement centered in the British Isles. All right? It was in the context of Puritanism that you had development. Out of the old amillennialism, there developed premillennialism and postmillennialism. Ian Murray, many of you have read his books with great profit, has written a book called Puritan Hope. And in his book on the Puritan Hope, he traces the development of postmillennialism in the 1600s and 1700s. This development begins, says Murray, with the teaching of the restoration or future conversion of the Jews by two early reformers in England or Britain. In other words, the first step in the development of postmillennialism was the idea, it was come up with by Martin Bucer, that's spelled B-U-S-E-C-E-R, pardon, B-U-C-E-R, and Peter Martyr, both of those men who were influential in England and in British Reformation, said that they saw in the Bible that there was going to be a future conversion of the Jewish nation. great revival among the Jews. They saw that prophesied in the Bible. And in fact, in the earliest Protestant Bible in England, called the Geneva Bible, this belief was expressed in the marginal notes. The Scofield Bible wasn't the first Bible to have marginal notes. There was the Geneva Bible, and in the margin of Romans 11, 25 and 26, it taught that there would be a future conversion of the Jews before Christ returned. In fact, here's what it says. He showeth, here's the marginal note, that the times will come that the whole nation of the Jews, though not everyone particularly, shall be joined to the Church of Christ. So they thought, Peter Martyr, Martin Bucer, that there would be this future conversion of the Jews. That was the first step. And Murray then traces how this belief became common among the Puritans. And he concludes, from the first quarter of the 17th century, belief in a future conversion of the Jews became commonplace among the English Puritans. Now, Martyr's view, Peter Martyr, was that this conversion of the Jews was to be one of the climactic events of history. This conversion of the Jews was going to happen just before Christ returned. And it would be like the sign of his coming. All right? Now, later developments, however, led to the expectation that associated with the conversion of the Jews would be a further glorious calling of the Gentiles. And that's step two. First of all, you have step one. There's going to be a future conversion of the Jews. And then some other people got to thinking about that and looking at Romans 11 again. They thought, and associated with a future conversion of the Jews, once the Jews are converted, there's going to be this great revival that will spread to all the nations. All right? That's step two. Jews converted, now a great revival among all the nations happens. Now, later, some theologians, among them some Puritans, identified both this future conversion of the Jews and the calling of the Gentiles more widely. They identified that with the millennium. In fact, said that Christ was going to come, and when Christ came, that would be when the Jews were converted, and that would be when the Gentiles were called. So that was a kind of premillennialism. Right? But others of the Puritans said, no, Christ isn't going to come before that happens. What's going to happen is the Jews will be converted, there'll be this calling of the Gentiles, and all that's going to happen before Christ comes. And then they identified that calling of the Gentiles, that future conversion of the Jews, with the millennium, but said that Christ was going to come afterwards, and only after all that had happened. And that was the birth of postmillennialism. All right? Let me show you that in chart form. There are four ideas here that Ian Murray traces out in the development of postmillennialism. And it was when these four ideas were there together that you had this development. So you have the development of postmillennialism after the Reformation. Here's what happened. First, you had the idea that the Jews would be converted. Not all of them, but a great revival. Idea two, in sequence, their calling to be associated with a further expansion of the church, and therefore not to be at the end. If after the Jews are converted, there's this further calling of the Gentiles, then the calling of the Jews, the revival among the Jews, can't be one of the last events in history, because it's going to take a while for all those Gentiles to be converted. So the conversion of the Jews can't take place right before the return of Christ. There's got to be a period of time. We might call that incipient, or a postmillennialism, or postmillennialism in seed form. And then idea three was this, that there would be a fuller development and future prosperity of the church to be identified with 1,000 years of peace in Revelation 20. Now the idea is that you know what that passage in Revelation 20 is actually about? That's about this period of time when the Jews are going to be nationally converted, the Gentiles will be called, and there will be this great golden age of righteousness and peace on earth before the second coming of Christ. That's systematic postmillennialism. And then the fourth idea is that some of them said, no, Christ is going to come before that, and that was a kind of premillennialism that a few, not many, but a few of the Puritans believed. Right. Now, the premillennialism, interestingly enough, didn't last long at this period of time because it was associated with a revolutionary movement in England. In England, not only did a few Puritans adopt this view, but there was a revolutionary movement. It was called the Fifth Monarchy Men. the Fifth Monarchy men were revolutionaries. And they were premillennialists, and they took their premillennialism in a revolutionary kind of direction. They were, of course, suppressed by the government, and no one wanted to be identified with these men that were revolutionaries. And so, again, at this point, the little bud of premillennialism was snipped off because it was associated with this revolutionary theory of the Fifth Monarchy men. Now, what happened after this? Well, Ian Murray tells the truth when he says that what we would call postmillennialism was to command very wide support in 18th and early 19th century Protestantism. So in other words, after about the mid to late 1600s, for a century and a half, postmillennialism was kind of like the majority report in terms of the eschatology of most Christians. Well, that's kind of shocking to us in our day, isn't it? But it's the truth. For a century and a half, from like the year 1700 to about the year 1850, most Christians who knew anything about it would have been postmillennial in their eschatology. Now, again, I managed to leave 10 minutes for questions. Let me show you the major diagrams we've looked at today. We have the three interpretive schemes of the Book of Revelation. You may have questions about that. The development of postmillennialism after the Reformation. You have questions about that. And you have the three major millennial views now. Premillennialism, amillennialism, and postmillennialism. You may have questions about that. All right, you have any questions? Yes, Bill. Yes. That's a good question. I don't know quite how to answer that, honestly. Yes, a historicist would say that some symbols in the Book of Revelation had to do with the future that hadn't happened yet, and with the time of the second coming of Christ, and Revelation 20 and all of those things. So yes, I suppose that they would. But with futurism, but with preterism, you know, there's a great big dispute about when the Book of Revelation was actually written. Preterists argue with a vengeance, and they have to, of course, because it destroys their theory if this isn't true, that the Book of Revelation was written in the 60s. It had to be written then because it was prophesying of things that are going to happen in the destruction of Jerusalem in 70. All right? Now, actually, I think a majority of interpreters over the history of the church have actually said that the Book of Revelation was written in more like 94, 95, 96. And if that theory were true, then preterism is completely blown out of the water because it was written 30 years after the destruction of Jerusalem or so. Okay? Yes, Tom. Probably so, and historicism would be consistent with postmillennialism because they would give, you see how that would be the case, they would give a symbolic interpretation of Revelation 19. They wouldn't see that as the second coming of Christ. That was a symbolic of his triumph over the nations and the coming of the millennium, and then they would interpret Revelation 20 as referring to their postmillennial kind of millennium. So you could be a historicist and postmillennial. Okay, we must not confuse these two things. Historicism, preterism, and futurism are methods of interpretation. Premillennialism, amillennialism, and postmillennialism are views of the millennium. They're two different things. Yes, David? Well, I don't know.
But that's not just true of preterism, is it? Futurism is the majority view of most evangelicals today. Dispensationalism is futurist in its interpretation of the book of Revelation. And if this historical data is right, both preterism and futurism developed or originated with Jesuit theologians combating Protestantism. So, how can it be? Well, how can it be? How can that be? Let's think about that. Well, you know, it can be, first of all, because of historical ignorance. Because most people don't know where futurism and preterism come from. Secondly, you know, it should make us think twice about futurism and preterism if it was really developed by Jesuit theologians combating the Reformation. That should certainly make us think twice about it. But you know, the Dan Rather view of truth isn't true. You know what the Dan Rather view of truth is? This will show my conservative roots. The Dan Rather view of truth is, if Dan Rather said it, it's wrong. Well, you know, it's possible for Roman Catholics sometimes actually to say things that are right. So, just because it originated with Jesuit theologians isn't proof positive that it's wrong. It should just make us think three or four times before we start to think it's right. Yes, David. Preterism provides a neat little escape hole to avoid all those kind of questions and problems. That may be one reason it's attractive to people. Now remember here, brethren, we're talking about preterism, not hyper-preterism. Hyper-preterism is not the view that we're talking about here. Hyper-preterism says that all the prophecy of the Bible was fulfilled in AD 70. It's something different, and not a view held by Christians. It's heretical. Although it does exist today. Right? Yes, Carl. Huh? Yeah. Well, that's a good question. The progression is this. Idea one and idea two are pretty clear. The Jews are converted. And then the second idea added to that was that the Gentiles are called in a great revival associated with that. Now, idea 3 and 4 both have to do with the identification of this period of time when the Jews are nationally converted and the Gentiles, there's this great revival across the world. Both idea 3 and 4 associate that with the 1,000 years of Revelation 20. Okay? Both of them. But the one that associates it with the premillennial interpretation of it, it says Christ comes and that's what kicks off the conversion of the Jews and the calling of the Gentiles. And then the other one says, no, Christ comes after the 1,000 years, and the 1,000 years is this great reign of peace and prosperity and the gospel on earth before Christ comes back. Am I answering your question? Charles Hofstetler, you did have your hand up. Go ahead. Okay. All right. Patrick? Okay, good question. Patrick is asking, with regard to these three views of how to interpret the book of Revelation, is there an alternative? And if so, who holds what? Now, let me say, there is an alternative today to these interpretations, and I'm not saying that everybody was one of these three things. Some people weren't any of these three things and had never thought about it. But for instance, William Hendrickson today, in his book that many of you have read, More Than Conquerors, holds what he calls the kingdom historical view. And it's like historicism in that it says that most of the book has to do with this period of between the first and second advent of Christ, but it's not like it because it doesn't believe it's a consecutive chronological account of history. That you have these big symbols of this period of time between the first and second advent of Christ throughout the book of Revelation as you move along, and it repeats itself. So he would say that the book of Revelation is repetitious. Historicism would say that it is consecutive
chronological account. Am I making that clear?
Okay.
Now, as to who holds what today, probably most amillennials would hold something like William Hendrickson's view, kingdom historical view. Most postmillennialists today, and this is something I didn't point out, but which we should talk about, most postmillennials today are some form of preterist. Why? Well, now who knows what their motivations are? I'm not going to talk about their motivations, but I will tell you that it's very convenient for a postmillennialist to be a preterist. Why? Well, because you know you have all these passages in the Bible that have this seem to have this very dark, gloomy, disastrous view of the future before just before Christ comes back. And all those dark, gloomy, disastrous views of the future in the Bible don't comport well with this glorious golden age that's supposed to be happening just before Christ comes back, according to postmillennialism. See that? And so it's very convenient for postmillennialists to say, all those dark, gloomy, disastrous things, they're all talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and we're beyond all that now. And so they don't have to apply those things to the end of time, and so now they can have their postmillennialism without all the problems that those dark, gloomy passages cause, because they were all talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, which already happened. Does that make sense? Now, that's a very prejudiced way of putting it, okay? But it is very convenient for them because of that. Now, so most postmillennials today tend to be preteristic. You know, there's something else, too, that's interesting. Postmillennialism, not always, but frequently enough to raise your eyebrows, tends to be associated with the idea that you have this state that's Christian that is empowered to suppress all the wrong religions. Now that's where it came from in Augustine, remember? His incipient kind of postmillennial structure that he had there, although he wasn't quite a postmillennialist, came from his idea that now we're in a new period of time, the church is no longer persecuted, the church is triumphant, the kings of the earth have kissed the Son, and now those kings are responsible to suppress all the wrong religions. Now, not all postmillennialists, but in our day, the theonomists and the reconstructionists hold about that idea of a Christian state. It's surprising. And they're postmillennial. The theonomists believe that the Old Testament judicial law should be the law of a land and in almost one-for-one fashion be implemented in the United States of America, the Old Testament judicial law. And the Reconstructionists believe that, and I read, for instance, one of them who's still alive today, who said it clearly, that Christians should work to have the federal government remove the tax exemptions of liberal churches. Think of the implications of that. Dennis. Well, true. Now, but we have to say that there's a difference among postmillennials about how this period of time will be ushered in. And we don't want to think that all postmillennials, I've got to stop with this, but I'll just respond to it because I don't know if I say this again and I want to say it. Postmillennialists, these people that believe that the millennium is going to come before Christ comes back, have all sorts of different ideas about how it's going to come. Some are catastrophic postmillennials. They believe that something like Y2K is going to happen. The whole world is going to come crumbling down, and all those smart Christians will have bought gold and have stored up for the future, and then they're going to emerge out on top after this catastrophe. All right? Well, they really believe that. There's a kind of a survivalist postmillennialism. There are others that say, no, the millennium is going to come gradually over a period of time. Just as Christians embrace God's covenant law and they keep keeping God's covenant law, and God's covenant law is going to make them wealthy and prosperous, and they're just going to rise to the top eventually and rule the world. There are others that say, no, that's not the way it's going to happen. What's going to happen is the gospel is going to keep getting preached and preached and preached and preached and preached, and eventually God's going to bless, there's going to be a great revival, the gospel's going to bring the millennium. So there are all sorts of different kinds of postmillennialists.
okay, in terms of how they get the millennium there, after all. And we have to close because I'm late. Matt Vincent, would you close this in prayer?